Accession number 8736, rule number 8.
Lord Harding, tape 8. So what happened to you after the Third Battle of Gaza? You didn't go on to Jerusalem, I gather, with Allenby.
No, we advanced behind the cavalry. The Desert Mandy Corps went streaking ahead in full pursuit of the Turks. And we followed up on the coastal side. And there was no fighting as far as we were concerned. And eventually we got to north to Darfur. But I think before then we were in camp at Lida, which was in the plains in what's now called Samaria, I think, which was an Arab town, small town in the plain there, and. We were there for a bit, and then I think the division was put into to the attack north of Jaffa. We moved into Jaffa, and we took part in the offensive, the offensive, which I think it was called the Battle of Megiddo, against the Turkish position, which ran from Jaffa to Jerusalem, so covering both Jaffa and Jerusalem.
Is there anything of note regarding that attack that you could tell us about?
Well, yes. See, the brigade that I was with was put to attack a feature. I can't remember what it was called. You've got first of all the geography of the place. There was the coast with sand dunes up to a certain level. Then there was an open plain. And then there were the foothills, the Judean foothills, and we were on the foothills. And the brigade's job was to capture a feature which was held by the Turks, something called Kelil something or other, which was there was an old, I don't know, it was a Crusader castle, an old castle, and there were rugged rock covered hills, not very high. And our job was to, my brigade's job was to attack that, and I had organized the machine gun support and the machine gun the guns to follow up the attacking infantry, and that was a successful operation. It was carefully planned. There was a good artillery support, a good counter battery work, and it went like a chime of bells. I don't remember any particular incident about it, but it was successful. And then we started to advance again. And then the cavalry, the Desert Mounted Corps, went on. And again, we followed them up until we got to Acre. Acre, the troops call it. I call it Acre, but it doesn't matter. And we marched without any fighting until we got up there. And then, again, from there, we went on to Beirut without any. We didn't take part in any of the fighting between Jaffa and Beirut. And Beirut had been evacuated by the Turks when we got there. And the best thing I remember, my most vivid recollection of that, is that we were. There was to be a victory march to Beirut, and Allenby was coming up to take the salute. And we bivouacked a few miles south of Beirut. And my mess corporal, my company, we had a mess cart, a mule pull cart, which our mess supplies in. And there's a drink that you get there called arak, which is an aniseed drink, And if you get filled up with it, and you wake up in the morning not only with a hangover, but with a burning thirst. And once you start, you have started drinking water, the arak starts to operate again. And apparently he'd gone off, I suppose. By that time, we were getting some supplies from the local people, things like eggs, and I don't remember chicken, but eggs and bread, that local bread, which was very good. And he had a fill-up of arak, woke up, I suppose, in the morning, and had a drink of water, and then went and harnessed up his nest cart and drove lickety-split through Beirut in advance of the Victory March. So that caused me a bit of trouble. Anyway, we took part in the Victory March in Beirut. And then...
was that like, the Victory March? Was it a big affair?
It was very impressive. You know, I can't remember how many troops took part. I remember... by that time, I'd got a captured Turkish pony, very wonderful little pony. He only stood about 14 hands, I suppose, that sort of thing. And he was a splendid chap. And I I think I'd taken over the battalion by that time, I think I had. 54th Machine Gun Battalion. And I led my chaps past Allenby, who was in the center of Beirut. I remember that Beirut was a very desolate place at that time. It hadn't been bombarded, but people were starving, and we found sort of dead bodies in the gutter here and there. Not very many, but a few. And the place was desolate. And we were moved through Beirut and north of it, between Beirut and Tripoli, where all this business has been going on recently. And quite near the coast. And my chaps were distributed in company areas, in bivouac. And I was back commanding 163 Company. I took over the battalion at a later stage, I think. And we were really waiting to see what had happened. And by that time, Desert Mounted Corps had gone up to Aleppo. And so the chap called Rosser, who was a regular soldier and who was on the, I think he was second in command of the battalion. At that time, they'd four machine gun battalions. And he and I arranged to go off on a trek. And we went over the Lebanon. We hitchhiked. There were lorry convoys moving about and supplying the troops and going forward to the Desert Mounted Corps. We hitchhiked over the Lebanon to a place called Zali, where we spent the night. And then we went on it was called something else. Then we went on to where the beginning of the railway that ran from there to up to Aleppo. And it was under construction then. By my vivid recollection of that, there was a Turkish camp there, Turkish huts there. Then we walked into the Turkish huts, this chap and I. We went with our valises and a bottle of whiskey or something, whatever we had, and a few tins of sardines. That's what we had. And we reckoned to live on the country. We walked into these huts and came out absolutely covered, our knees absolutely black with fleas from the Turkish huts. But we managed to find one of the construction trains, and they were going up to Aleppo, and we asked them to drop us off at Baalbek, because we'd heard about Baalbek and we thought we'd like to see it. And so we we got into this train, and the early hours of the morning, they decanted us in Baalbek. We dropped our kit on the side of the road and walked into the town and went to look at the Roman temple there. It's a very famous one, very marvelous. And we were there before sunrise, and we saw the sunrise from the over the anti-Lebanon, and strike the snow on the top of the Lebanon to start with, and then come down across the plain, covering, lighting up the Roman temple. And that was very, very impressive, very interesting. And then we thought we'd like some food, so we walked back into Baalbek, sort of small little village place, and we saw a sign, something brigade headquarters, one of the I think it was one of the yeomanry divisions. And so we went to what was obviously a small inn, or the equivalent of an inn in those parts. So we went in and we asked for breakfast, and they said they hadn't got any food, they'd only got the brigadier's breakfast. So we said, all right, give us the brigadier's breakfast. There was nobody else about at the time. So we had some eggs, and I don't know we had coffee, probably something like that. And then we thought, well, we'd better decamp. So we got out of this place and walked down around the road about a mile outside, and waited on the roadside for a lorry with our kit. Sitting on the side of the road, a lorry came along, was bound for Damascus. So we hitchhiked our way to Damascus. And we went into Damascus, where we found a hotel. My best recollection of that was that they had some very good some real sherry. Anyway, and we were in Damascus, going around, looking around, you know, enjoying ourselves, when Faisal's chaps came and marched, rode in. they were full of the joys of spring. They galloped around the city, firing off their guns in the air. That was about the most dangerous time of all, I think, during that advance.
Who were these people that came in? You say Faisal.
Faisal,
yes.
The Arabs.
Ah, yes.
Lawrence's lot.
Yes. Did you ever see him, Lawrence?
No, I never met Lawrence, but they were his chaps. They were the group that came into Damascus and occupied Damascus. And then, because we had to get back to our unit, so we stayed in Damascus. And I remember going and looking in the bazaar there, which is a fascinating place. And you could see Mount Hermon just below. It was terribly interesting, but we hadn't got time to go on up further up. And so we hitchhiked our way back to our unit in between Beirut and Tripoli. And we were there till after Christmas or... Meantime, of course, there was an armistice with the Turks.
Yes. Your trip, this little trip you took, was that before the armistice or after, when you went off hitchhiking?
Oh, it was after the armistice.
It would have been, yes.
We wouldn't have been allowed to go before the armistice.
Yes, that's what I was wondering. If it was a
rest... It must have been after the armistice.
Yeah.
So that, and then a small operation.
Yes, this is the Battle of the River Auger going to tell me about, isn't it?
Yes, well, it was preliminary to... there was a river that ran... I don't know where it started, but it ran across the plain, and it had to be crossed for the final offensive against the Turkish position there. And so it was decided to launch a comparatively minor operation to establish a bridgehead across the river. It was not a big river. It ran fairly deep between... not very high banks, but across the plain, and the object was to establish a bridgehead across the river, and to build a bridge there for the troops to take part in this offensive, and that was a comparatively minor operation. I don't remember there being any difficulty or any problem, but it was the usual thing as far as I was concerned of. of providing machine guns to go forward with the attacking infantry, and other machine guns in reserve behind. I don't think we used any overhead fire in that connection. I don't believe we did. So it was, as far as I was concerned, it was a comparatively simple and successful operation on the fairly. I don't know. It might have been. It probably was a brigade operation. I don't know whether there were two brigades or whether the thing was done on the. But it was an assault crossing over this river. They established a bridgehead, and that was done.
Quite
it was a necessary preliminary to the main attack on the Turkish position.
And that would have been towards the end of 1917.
That would be towards the end of 1917, yeah.
Could I ask you a little more about your general staff appointment? I think this was when you got a grade two general staff appointment, didn't you? Was it with General Bulfin's staff?
I was made. They decided to have a corps machine gun officer with much the same responsibilities as that I had had as a divisional machine gun officer, but covering a corps front. And that was. By that time, the army in Palestine had been organized in two corps. There was the corps on the coast, which was commanded by a chap called Bulfin, and the chief of staff was a chap called Salt. And then there was the other corps, and I can't remember whether it was 30, one was 13, and the other was not 13, but I can't remember what it was. Anyway, it seemed to be in that book. And the other one was commanded by, on the inland side, was commanded by Chetwood, with Archie Wavell as his chief of staff. BGSs they were called in those days. They weren't called chiefs of staff. And I was appointed as a G2 to be corps machine gun officer of the Coastal Corps. And that meant coordinating the machine gun defences, first of all, and then their support of the offensive when the offensive started. I think it was on a two, maybe yes, it was on a two divisional front. And so that again was very valuable from my point of view because I had to think at corps level. And get to know how a corps staff operated and what a corps front was and all the thinking business of interdivisional boundaries and plans for artillery support and all the rest of it. So it was an advance in my process of military education, which was very valuable. So I was lucky in that respect because I graduated from brigade front, divisional front, corps front, and that was a very good education.
And I suppose all at different levels, you were requiring very different skills, were you not? Well, building on them.
Well, you had thinking on a different scale.
Yes.
but the same general type of responsibilities. And I was the most interesting thing about that period, as far as I was concerned, was that my brigadier general staff, he was called Salt, I think his name was, and Archie Wavell, who was chief of staff of the other corps, exchanged letters about their respective positions and their plans, and we were. Wavell's letters to my BGS were passed around at G2 level for people to see. So that was my first sort of acquaintance indirectly with Wavell. And I remember being very impressed by the letters, you know, their briefness, their clearness. They were both brief and clear, and extremely valuable and interesting. So that was a useful experience, and that was my first acquaintance, an indirect acquaintance with Archie Wavell.
You're going to see a lot of him, I think,
saw
in
a lot
the future.
Of him later
yes.
On, yeah.
So that was an enjoyable position, was it?
Well,
at corps
level? Yes. I met, you know, I got to know the rest of the staff. I can't remember any. There was one or two. The G2 operations became a close friend of mine. I can't remember his name now, but they were all regular officers. And so this was a graduation, both to staff work and to working with other regular officers.
Were you still managing to have contacts with the men, the other ranks?
Not so much then. Not in that job, not so much.
Did you miss that?
Well, I think so. But I was very busy. Yes, no, you had contacts, but they weren't on the same scale as when I was commanding a company. And then I went from there to command the divisional machine gun, machine gun battalion. I took over from a chap called Pickett Moody. But I didn't command the battalion in any battle. It was after the actual fighting. Although the Desert Mounted Corps may have been fighting a bit up north, but as far as I was concerned, there was no contact with the enemy. While when I was commanding the machine gun battalion, and then we moved on to Alexandria, awaiting demobilization. Demobilization and return to home. And one particularly awkward incident. We were in camp outside Alexandria, and one night one of my companies had, I think, about a dozen rifles stolen. There were a lot of rifle thieves about, of course. And the Egyptians were pretty good at it, very good at it. And the troops had to sleep with their rifles beside them in their tents. We were in tents then. And we had, I don't know how many it was, about 10 or a dozen rifles stolen, I suppose. So that created a frightful stir. Of course, we were under a cloud for a bit, and we managed to survive a court of inquiry, and I wasn't tried by court-martial, but I probably ought to have been.
Would that have been the norm?
I don't think so. I think at that stage, you know, the fighting was over, and we were all just waiting to go home. No, I don't think so. I don't think it would have been, but...
What did you think of the natives in the area, you know, these various areas you went through? When you were in Palestine, for instance, did you have much contact with the people?
Not much. We hated the Palestinian Arab. He was a terrible chap.
Why was that?
Well, they robbed the dead, they mutilated the wounded, and made themselves, and of course they were looking for loot. And they made themselves thoroughly objectionable. They're very different. The Palestinian Arab, in my experience, is a very different type of chap from the Bedouin, the genuine desert Arab. They're very different, both in their way of life and in their standards of behavior. I don't know. I suppose the PLO, the present PLO, are composed mainly. Well, they must be because the others are all in Jordan. Composed mainly of the successors, the children and the descendants of the what we used to call the Badus, who were the Palestinian Arabs, who we hated. And of course, at that time, you see, Palestine, there were only three Jewish settlements in Palestine. There was the Tel Aviv on the coast, with Jaffa. There was one place called Sarona, which was inland before you came to the foothills, and then there was Wilhelmina, which was right up against the Judean foothills. And there were three separate settlements. But there was no overall Jewish population. But there were orange groves at Jaffa, north and all around Jaffa. And I remember very vividly, we used to go around my machine gun positions in the morning and pull a ripe orange down, a lovely, lovely Jaffa orange down from a tree from the orange trees, and refresh myself on my rounds that way. But there was no general Jewish Israeli occupation. And I remember, well, at Haifa, north of Haifa, riding across the plain of Sharon when we were waiting there with the, well, the wildflowers, all the whole plain was a mass of wildflowers up to my horse's knees. Marvelous. Well, that, of course, is all intensively cultivated later. But that was the, and there were these Arab villages, townships, dotted about. There was one, there were a number of others. Haifa was mainly Arab. But they were not unduly friendly. But we formed a very bad opinion of them.
Yes, and how about the Egyptians?
Oh, the Egyptians. Well, they are Egyptians. They've always been the same. The Fellaheen. Their motivation is money. I mean, they're very industrious. And you see them working away on their farms in the delta, drawing the water up with mule or donkey, going round and round and pulling the water up into their irrigation channels. Extremely industrious, not very attractive, but not unduly hostile. And then in Cairo, same. Both in Cairo and Alexandria, there's a very large, or was in those days, still is, I expect, a very large Levantine element in the population, who were mainly the shopkeepers and the hotel keepers and the cafe keepers and so on. Now, they're not a particularly attractive people, but they're not hostile. They weren't in those days, and they worked hard. And I think their standard of living was pretty slow, and their living conditions were pretty rough and ready. That was my impression at the time, by our standards.